From RTE Radio 1, you're listening to Arena Encore.
Broken English is probably the only name you could give to a documentary about the artist Marianne Faithfull. Not only is it the title of a Grammy-nominated album that in 1979 marked a significant comeback against all odds, personal and professional in her life, it hints at the innovative, fragmentary approach the directors take to telling that remarkable story. Jane Pollard and Ian Forsyth are the directors in their reframing. Tilda Swinton plays a bureaucrat in charge of the Ministry of Not Forgetting, with George Mackay as the record keeper, the man who shows Marianne old footage of herself performing and in many TV interviews. I'm delighted Jane Pollard joins us now. Jane, tell me first of all about the structure that you chose to use for this and why, because it is genuinely innovative.
Oh, thank you. Well, I don't think you can face making a film about an artist as complicated and interesting and exciting and as who's had such a remarkable career as Marianne Faithfull, and not attempt to do that by meeting her creatively with it. So that was really our idea at the outset, was how do we make this but fill it with her spirit and her ideas? How do we go in not deciding it from the outset what this should be, but let her guide us and show us what it is that she's, you know, has meant the most to her through her life? And wow, what a journey we went on. It's been an incredible process making it. It's been amazing to get to know Marianne. What a brilliant woman. But yeah, the film itself has turned out, it's turned out all right, I think.
It's not the first time that you've done documentaries like this. You did the BAFTA award-winning 20,000 Days on Earth about Nick Cave. You've made films about Gil Scott-Heron and The Cramps. But when did Marianne occur to you as possibly the next project?
You know, she didn't. It was brought to us shamefully, and exactly why we titled this Broken English is her reputation in England is still broken. And Ian and I were school kids in the 70s and 80s who grew up only ever hearing that awful lie that was told about her after the Redlands drug bust. And she'd really kind of got stuck in that rut of being Mick Jagger's ex-girlfriend, and the 30 or so albums that came after that, the astonishing accolades and achievements, all pretty much passed us by. That was until artists that we do know very well started working with her. So Nick Cave and Warren Ellis, Jarvis Cocker, Damon Albarn, PJ Harvey, Anna Calvi, all these artists that mean an awful lot to us, started to collaborate with her and write with her. You know, Nick and Warren have worked on her last six albums. And that kind of made us turn, you know, that turned our head and made us take her more seriously. And then a producer brought the idea to us, and we just thought, what a remarkable place to start. This is somebody that we haven't grown up a fan of. We don't know everything about them, but how great that we might be able to set a record straight and to tell the story from a clean slate, you know, to approach it completely afresh.
Because I think depending on who you are, and I suppose depending on when you grew up, you will have a different perception of Marianne Faithfull. There's the whole girlfriend of Mick Jagger, which is always drawn out. There's that 1960s pop icon face, there's that incredible voice. There's the 1980s comeback. And she was no pushover as a person. I'm wondering that when you met her in October 2021, she was in a very different situation at that point. Her health had been very damaged by COVID. So what was that like the first time you met her?
Oh, I mean, she's still no pushover at that point. It was absolutely terrifying meeting her, and I think that we had to pass a test in a way. I said nervously, "Oh, Marianne, hello! It's so wonderful to meet you. How are you?" And she said, "Well, how the hell do you think I am? Look at me, look at me!" And I laughed, and I think I passed the test in that moment. I think she saw, you know, she saw that we got her. She's an amazing artist, but over there, you have such a different view of her. You know, it's so, she absolutely loved being in Ireland, and she thought that that place was a haven for her and her creativity. It completely changed her world. It really did. It helped her kind of regain her feet, I think.
I'm interested to know, because there's not an enormous amount of that contained within the documentary itself, and obviously you can't touch on everything in somebody's life throughout the course of a brief documentary like this. Why was that?
We mainly kind of followed the things that really lit her up. And of course, we did talk about Shell Cottage in one of the film days that we were. But to be honest, it just didn't kind of, it didn't have any substance. It didn't have a through line that connected us to these much grittier, much more muscular bits of her story. Whereas, you know, talking about the origins of her talent and her kind of interests in music coming from folk rather than pop, her being friends with the beat poets and learning a kind of much more radically interesting, open-minded kind of countercultural way of thinking, that is incredibly surprising to those of us who only encountered her through the pop charts, really.
Okay.
That all felt much juicier.
Yeah, I want to take something from the film. So let's hear from Tilda Swinton encapsulating Marianne Faithfull in 1 minute.
The building is old and my team is small, but let's not get into all that now. It's time to prove our concept. The more we uncover, the more confident I am that Marianne is the perfect choice for our first subject. We can't risk waiting any longer. A career spanning 6 decades, over 30 albums, a vast stream of adoring collaborators, everyone from Paul McCartney to Metallica to the Vienna Radio Symphony Orchestra, a Grammy nomination for Broken English, the Commander des Arts et des Lettres awarded by the French government, it goes on. She survived addiction, overdoses, cancer, and more recently, a coma brought about by COVID. And yet, to the world at large, she's still just Mick Jagger's ex-girlfriend. Well, fuck that.
What did she make of the concept when you did convince her to take part in the documentary and you explained the nature of how she was going to participate in it? What did she make of that?
Well, she was wary at first, thankfully. You know, we were too. I think that our work tends to push into territory that it's right. You know, it's a little pretentious. It uses construct. It's trying to do something new, and I think it's right to be wary of that. But Marianne has lived her life in the height of theatricality, steeped in the poets and playwrights. She, even in the care home, when we went to see her, her room was lavish and it had portraits of Francis Bacon on the wall, books everywhere. You know, she created her own creative universe. And I think we needed to give her a stage, a space in the film, that met her with some of that creativity. You know, the dryness of a documentary or the sort of blankness of a Wikipedia entry just doesn't serve anybody's life story well. We needed to bring her heart and her soul onto the screen. And I think the Ministry of Not Forgetting gave us a starting chance at that. And it turned out pretty good. Tilda Swinton did a damn good job, didn't she?
Yeah, and I think I like George MacKay very much. He takes the role of the record keeper here, which means that he's the one who's talking to Marianne most of the time and taking on what would be the traditional role of an interviewer in this situation. He's a great interviewer. Aside from everything else, he seems to do an absolutely wonderful job of just leading her gently along. How much of that was scripted, and how much of that is George just walking down laneways that he felt might work?
So it's very sort of semi-scripted. Because Marianne's entirely improvised, George had to really think on his feet. We're so lucky that we've worked with George a number of times now on varying projects. And we know him really, really well as a person. And I think that we need, when we're working with actors in these improvised documentary style projects, we need to know what reserves they're going to pull on. And with George, he has the warmest heart and the most curious of minds. And I think you see that on screen, that he just, he wanted to create space for her to really open up and try and sort of think afresh about, you know, her life, some of which was being shown to her. And because of the effects of COVID, it was almost like she was seeing it for the first time, or like she was meeting an old friend in this army of older, younger Mariannes that turned up to take part in the film.
You would expect in a documentary like this to have the traditional lineup of talking heads, as so many documentaries do. You don't go down that route at all, but at the same time, you still manage to allow people to have their say about Marianne, but just in very different ways.
Yeah, do you know, I often feel when I'm watching documentaries that use the kind of that use talking heads, that it's about that person, so they're elbowing their way into another person's story, trying to kind of create a piece in brackets with, you know, I'm relevant because here's the reason. And those sorts of tangents don't really build up a kind of fulfilling, wholesome, you know, picture. You really want to be able to let that person speak for themselves. And when I say speak for herself, I mean, Marianne does an awful lot with just her eyes and her face in this film. Just the act of us watching her, watching herself, her younger self, her broken self, her brilliant self doing, you know, the seven deadly sins, all of these kind of, the way her face takes it in, I think speaks so much to us. We're all very literate in reading nuanced gestures of the human face. And Marianne's got an amazing face to watch. So we tried to let it do quite a lot of the speaking. And then, yeah, use people in other ways.
One of those ways, and it's a really interesting one, is there's a debate at one point in the film that feels almost like a recording of a podcast. As various women, including Edith Bowman, is there, and Sophie Fiennes and Natasha Khan, and they're all commenting on the misogyny and the sexism that she was up against right from the start. She had an enormous amount to contend with pretty much from day one, didn't she?
She did, yes. And you know what's so interesting? Marianne, in the first 3 days of filming that we did with her and George, there's that moment where George puts the newspaper of Redlands in front of her. And she says to him, no, I don't care for that much. I'm not going to talk about that. But you can show it to them. And at the time of filming, we had no idea who she meant. Did she mean us, the directors, or the audience? I don't know. I don't know who she meant. But we kept coming back to that moment in the edit, and then we were like, oh, wait a minute, we could create a them and make it feel like she knew that they were there, and then just picked, you know, from the creme de la creme, you know, somebody from film, like you say, Sophie Fiennes, somebody from art history, Katie Hessel, some brilliant people, Harriet Viner, who wrote the Robert Fraser biography and had done so much research on the Redlands drug bust. And it was a great way of being able to stretch out and explore, again, all improvised, explore a topic that has still means a lot, still resonates a lot for a lot of contemporary female artists. But to do it without having to make Marianne trudge over that stuff again.
I want to get some Marianne herself in here. The song Broken English is a huge turning point for her as an artist. She wrote it in the late 1970s, and here she is looking back at it.
Broken English.
Yeah.
That's the result of an identity that's been flattened and is suddenly allowed to come up. I became myself, and it was not the person people thought I was. It was more intelligent, stronger.
It felt as if I was really finally doing something for myself that was very important. Mm. I had to do that. You know, if I die now, what have I done? Nothing. That's what I thought.
Was there a moment that you realised this is what I'm meant to be doing?
Yeah. As I was writing, I would have a feeling that, OK, I'm here now. This is what it is. This is it.
You have a lot of collaborators in this film as well who are singers themselves. Beth Orton is in the film. Courtney Love, they perform. Suki Waterhouse, they do covers. What do you think her legacy is to the singer-songwriters who came after her?
I mean, she's clearly had such an incredible impact on a lot of artists. She really is truly an artist's artist. You know, she's the real deal. I mean, Warren Ellis has said that to us so many times. She really is the real deal. But she is so, in the public eye, so underrated. We're about to start, as you know, tomorrow, in playing this film across countries. And wherever we can, we're going to take some of these supporters, these artists, who came out in their legions when we were looking for people to contribute to the film, to come with us and try and play at events and be there to support the film. It's really meaning a lot to have that crowd of people who dearly loved her and clearly rated her talent coming with us.
The film ends on a joyful note, despite that Tilda Swinton talks to screen about her having passed away before the film is completed. She sings a song with Nick Cave and Warren Ellis is there. And there's so much love in that room at the end for that performance. It's an extraordinary way to end the film.
Oh, that was one of the happiest days of my life, let alone Marianne's life. And it's the happiest I ever saw Marianne. She was in her element. We'd been so unsure whether she would be able to be well enough to make it to the studio or able to stay for longer than, say, 20 minutes. Certainly weren't totally confident that she was going to be able to sing. But, oh, my God, she pulls it out of the bag so incredibly. To be in the room with those people and their shared admiration for one another. It was a real treat. It really was.
Okay, I want to play a little bit of that. This is Marianne Faithfull, along with Nick Cave, singing Misunderstanding from the film.
I just have to trust Nick Cave.
Well, I'm just coming in. I'm just coming in only...
Which isn't always easy.
I'm a reformed character.
Yeah.
Give me a break. Right.
No, I know you are, Doug.
It's still completely untrustworthy.
A bit iffy.
I'm still working
You're
on
still
that.
A bit iffy.
Okay, a bit iffy.
Yeah.
That's my tombstone. Nick Cave, a bit iffy.
Yes. That's good.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, I like it.
Let's do Misunderstanding.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay, rolling, everyone.
Hang on. One, two, three, four.
Misunderstanding is my name. What I am is not a game. Such an easy trap to fall for anyone. And then you find yourself alone. No explanation you can give that you or I believe or understand.
That's Marianne Faithfull along with the voice of Nick Cave there, and Warren Ellis is on that as well, performing Misunderstanding from the very end of the documentary. It's been absolutely lovely to talk to you, and I hope the film brings you nothing but extraordinary success. Jane Pollard, thanks for joining us tonight on Arena.
Thank you so much. What a pleasure.
Broken English is screening at the Lighthouse Cinema tomorrow night at 6 o'clock as part of the Dublin International Film Festival. You'll find more details at diff.ie. And Broken English will go on general release in Irish cinemas on March 20th, so you'll have a chance to see it then. Thank you to the text you sent in this. Marianne and Mick Jagger stayed in Tumen, County Galway in the late 1960s. They stayed in a house outside the town, which was owned by the legendary Lady Molly Cusick-Smith, one of the most colourful characters on the Irish hunting scene. You've just heard the opening bars of Aladdin Sane, the title track of David Bowie's album from 1973. It was written while he was touring his alter ego Ziggy Stardust in the US. The pianist Mike Garson had joined the Spiders from Mars band for the tour, and his signature avant-garde jazz sound weaves through the Aladdin Sane album at a point when Bowie was looking for a new direction. Mike would contribute to 8 Bowie albums in all, from Aladdin Sane to Reality in 2003, and he'd also play live with him across those decades. He's here this week headlining at the Dublin Bowie Festival, along with other regular contributors of David's, including Earl Slick, Mark Platy, and our own Jerry Leonard. I'm delighted Mike Garson joins me now. You're very welcome to Arena, Mike.
Happy to be here. Happy to be here.
And welcome back to Dublin as well, although this is obviously far from your first visit here.
It's got to be my 5th or 6th. I played here with David Bowie in the mid-90s. And we did something again in 2004. And then I had my alumni band here a few times. And last year I played with Jerry Leonard here with the Symphony Orchestra. And this year I'm here with Jerry and Mark and Earl Slick and myself and some wonderful Irish singers. And it's terrific.
Okay, I'm going to scroll back ever so slightly and maybe ask you to take us back to 1972. You were an avant-garde jazz pianist. You were playing clubs in New York, and David Bowie arrives in the city on tour without a piano player. So how did you get that call for the very first audition?
I'm sitting in my house in Brooklyn giving a piano lesson. My wife is working, and my daughter is 1 year old. She's in a swing right next to the piano. And the phone rings, and it's David Bowie, and I don't know who he is. So let's start there. But something felt right about it. But then I had a problem. I'm in Brooklyn. I had to get to RCA Studios in New York City. My wife's not home, and it's a first lesson for a piano student. And I asked him if he could babysit my 1-year-old daughter. And to this day, it's a still PTSD traumatic incident for her. But he took good care of my daughter. I ran down there. I walk into the RCA Studios. Mick Ronson, who's an unsung hero, sitting at the piano, gives me the music to the song Changes. I read it. I play for 7 seconds. And Mick looks at David and they say, "You have the gig." So it's the fastest audition in my life. And I thought, well, either these guys are deaf or they can't play. I don't know how I got this gig. But they said they knew. And I was hired for 8 weeks. And God knows I became the longest standing member of the band, and maybe 400 shows. And God knows how many albums they keep putting out. Officially it was 8, but it's really around 20 now.
You were classically trained. You were a world away from the Ziggy Stardust world at the time. You had lessons, as I understand it, with the great Bill Evans and the great Herbie Hancock. Is that true? Tell me about that.
That's really true. And there was even another unsung hero who had played with Charlie Parker. His name was Lenny Tristano. He was a blind pianist. I also had some lessons with Chick Corea. Because the New York scene at that time, you know, I would go see John Coltrane, I'd go see Miles Davis. And when I met David Bowie, we were talking about Charlie Mingus, who's a very famous bass player and had a big band. So David and I connected through jazz, even though, you know, he was playing with the Spiders from Mars and the leader of that band. He loved jazz, and he was a good saxophone player. And he told me that if he had even been better, he would have not become a singer and songwriter. So we're all blessed that he wasn't great at the saxophone.
So you signed up initially for an 8-week tour, and you ended up recording 4 albums in the 70s, right the way up to Young Americans in 75. I want to ask you about that first. So what do you remember about making the Aladdin Sane album? You were in Trident Studios in London, which is a fairly famous place at the time.
Trident Studio was where Hey Jude was recorded. Queen recorded there. David had done Hunky Dory there and Ziggy. And they had the most wonderful piano there. And I was, you know, blessed to play it. And the band, don't forget, I'm used to playing in jazz clubs with no amplification. These guys had speakers up on the wall, and every night we blew them out. And they brought in new ones the next day and new ones the day after. They were just a great band. Ken Scott was a fantastic engineer and producer with David and Mick Ronson. And I just sat at the piano and it's like the notes, they found me, because that studio was so magical that there was nothing to do except just play what I felt in my heart. And David, what his strength was, is he never micromanaged his musicians. So he'd give you a vision, but he'd never do this or do that. And it gave me permission to play whatever was in my heart. And that's what I love him for.
That must have been great for you, because presumably in your jazz work, that was exactly what you were doing. You're used to having a lot of freedom in the way you played.
It's still that way. I mean, let's face it, I was really all those years, I must have played with 13 different bands over the 40-year span. And just between 72 and 75, when we finished Young Americans, he had actually fired five different bands. I was the only musician that lasted through it all, not because of personality things, but I was able to change styles because he was a chameleon that kept hearing new things, Diamond Dogs, pinups, you know, Aladdin Sane and Young Americans. Everything was continuously changing. And that was where I lived. I also would get tired of styles and I would move from jazz to classical to fusion music to pop, you know. So he liked that. And we continued making those records in those early days.
You're giving a masterclass here on Sunday as part of the Dublin Bowie Festival. It's one of the many events you're involved in. There's a reason why everyone asks you about this particular solo that we're about to play, the one from Aladdin Sane itself. It's incredible. Let's have a listen to it first. That's Mike playing on Aladdin Sane. Mike, I mean, one of the unusual elements is just how prominent your piano is in that song.
I mean, David, I got the feeling after Ziggy got a little tired for a little bit of time of the guitar. So it became a piano album, unbeknownst to me. I had nothing to compare it to because it was my first album with him. So I thought it was normal. And then I realized he's really featuring the piano. Now, the thing that's bizarre is that Aladdin Sane solo that you just played, it's the only song anyone has ever talked about to me for 50 years. And it was David's genius that solo came about, because I played it through his head. Like, if he could play the piano as well as I could, what would he play? I didn't know that initially. Initially, I played a blues solo. He said, no, that's too commonplace. Play something else. I played a Latin solo. And he said, no, I'm looking for something like you did on the New York jazz scene. I said, why would you want that? He said, I want something wild and way out there and avant-garde. And I said, well, that's exactly why I'm not working Saturday night. And he said, leave that to me. I'll know how to frame it. And it was a one take. I got it in one take.
Well, maybe people only ever usually talk to you about that solo. I'm going to shake that up. So there is the opening of Lady Grinning Soul, the final track on Aladdin Sane. Let's have a listen to that as well. That's Lady Grinning Soul. Mike, tell me a little bit about that and about your other work on the album.
So Lady Grinning Soul comes in number two for comments around the world. But what's crazier, nobody knows this, but David never sang it live in all the shows I did with him, 400 shows. And I never found out why, because it's one of his most beautiful songs.
I want to fast forward to the 90s. You make three albums then with David. I want to ask you about Outside. So recorded in Switzerland in 95 with Brian Eno and Carlos Alomar on guitar. What are your memories of that time and of that recording?
That album is one of my favorite albums. And it was my favorite album ever with any artist, including David, to record, because David said to me, he said, Mike, I'm going to put together my favorite musicians of the last 30 years, and it's going to be you and Carlos and Brian Eno and Reeves Gabrels and Sterling Campbell. What we're going to do is we're going to go into the studio and we're going to improvise for a few weeks, and then Brian and I are going to turn them into songs and have these interludes with all these improvisations going on. And that takes a lot of trust. And we just went in there and improvised several hours a day. We had two Sony tape recorders at the time attached to each other. We could do 48 tracks at the time. And we would just play and play, and he would put things in our headphones. We'd be listening to soul music and he'd tell us to play against it, and then they'd remove the soul music and what would come out would be just something wild. And Brian would give us various instructions. Picture yourself being on another planet in the year 3000. And I mean, it was really wild. But the thing was that David said to me, he felt bad about his music in the 80s. Now, I don't feel bad about it because you get Absolute Beginners and Loving the Alien, but he didn't like it. He felt he sold out because of the pressure from Let's Dance, and the record companies wanted more of that. Once you fall into that rabbit hole, the game is over. So he has a lot of integrity, and he said, Mike, I got to get back to myself, and the only way I could do it is if I put this group of musicians together and we go in and do something 180 degrees opposite of my last 10 years. So I was really, really flattered. And it was my best experience in co-creating with him. And of course, we all contributed to those songs. So I'm a composer of those pieces, like Heart's Filthy Lesson and Small Plot of Land. I mean, the album, nobody knows that album. Everyone knows Ziggy, obviously, and they know Aladdin Sane and Hunky Dory. That album, it's now 30 years, and people are starting to wake up for it. And the fact that you're talking about it makes me very happy.
Well, in case people haven't heard it before, let's take a little bit of Heart's Filthy Lesson. This is from Outside.
It's the Heart's Filthy Lesson. Heart's Filthy Lesson.
So you must have played hundreds of live shows with Bowie over the years, and that includes the reality tour in 2003 here, that Dublin gig at the Point. It's one of those legendary evenings that's passed into folklore here. What was it like to share a stage with Bowie and to play live with him?
You know, he particularly chose Dublin because, like myself, it's one of our favorite places in the world to play. Whatever it is, I like the people here, you know? And he did too. And we did a lot of concerts in preparation for recording a DVD and CD, et cetera, at that time. So we did two nights and we got some wonderful music that was, you know, we have it now saved forever. I played there last year with Symphony Orchestra with Jerry Leonard, and there was Gail Ann Dorsey, one of our alumni, and Sterling Campbell and Jerry again, and Mark Platy. So this year we're back to a small group, but I can't seem to stop coming here. I don't know. When we went to the pub afterwards, there was not even any beer left. There were so many people in there.
Just to finish, Bowie kept news of his illness as quiet as he could. Can I ask you about the last time you heard from him? What was that like?
It was actually very sad because he kept it hidden, except probably to his wife, you know, and maybe Tony Visconti knew, but we didn't know. And I'm in Los Angeles and he's in New York. And someone was writing a book, his name was Cliff Slapper, at the time, a biography on me, and it was called David Bowie's Piano Man. And at one point, the writer, Cliff, calls me and he said, I want you to listen to these 60 or 70 songs you've played with David over the last 40 years, all at once. Now, I had never done that as an exercise. So I spent hours listening to everything all in a row. And I was overwhelmed, and I wrote David an instant email, and I said, I can't believe I just listened to everything we've done together all in a row for several hours. And within 3 seconds, he wrote back. He said, Mike, we did a wonderful legacy of music together. And I got off the phone and I said to my wife, Susan, I said, I think that's the last time I'm ever going to hear from him. There was something final about that email. And I turned out to be right. I didn't know he'd be dying a few months later.
Mike Carson, it's been brilliant to talk to you tonight on the program, and thanks so much for joining us on Arena.
Well, thank you so much.
Mike is taking part in a series of discussions as part of the Dublin Bowie Festival, which runs until the 1st of March. You'll find more details at dublinbowiefestival.ie.
You're listening to Arena Encore. You can listen to Arena every weeknight from 7 on RTE Radio 1 and the RTE Radio Player app.
Now, did you know that old Sultans of Ping t-shirts, which you'd save in a house fire, are actually art? Or that old Charlatans t-shirt you have, or the Ratty Oasis one from the first time around, or that Toasted Heretic t-shirt, which is so old and faded and holy in every sense of the word. A new exhibition in Drogheda is celebrating the not-so-humble band t-shirt, and joining me now is Cliona Murphy, who's one of the coordinators of Sweat, Sounds and Stories, which is being shown at the Kiosk Project Art Space in Drogheda for the rest of the week. Cliona, you're very welcome.
Thank you.
The exhibition is billed as a love letter to music and to design and community and the younger self. Why do you think that band t-shirts hold so much resonance and power for people?
Well, to be honest, I didn't realise how much meaning and love and attachment there was to low band t-shirts until a conversation had at a punk gig, an all-ages punk gig, last year when a few of us middle-agers, we were chatting about the number of band t-shirts that had accumulated over the years. One avid music fan said he had 76 band t-shirts and 3 pairs of jeans. So people told stories, yeah, of boxes of t-shirts in the attic, drawers full of them. So I was asking about setting them free, giving them a second life, you know, maybe selling or auctioning them as a fundraiser or a benefit at an upcoming gig. However, as the conversation went on, I realised that many didn't want to let them go. And there was still such a bond and attachment to the memories and the meanings that the t-shirts brought and stories were told. So I suggested maybe attaching a letter of introduction to the t-shirt, still hoping to proceed with the idea of an auction or a sale as a benefit. And the letter of introduction could introduce the t-shirt to the prospective owner. However, what happened was, in the meantime, Brian Hegarty of 3345 and the Kiosk in Drogheda heard about the idea and he got in touch with me. So he had recently been involved in setting up this artist-led creative community hub in Drogheda with Rita. It's run in association with the Drogheda Arts Centre and it's a small space. Actually, it's a tiny space. But what was quite unique about it is that you can make it your own. And I felt really daunted when he suggested the idea because I have no experience of curating or putting together exhibitions. But, you know, I got great support from Brian and Rita and they really midwifed the idea into this exhibition now that has 25 band t-shirts, each with a letter accompanying them. Yeah, so...
I can completely understand the idea of people not wanting to give away those precious T-shirts. I mean, I'm one of those people. Is there an element of frequently those T-shirts are attached to a single gig on a single night, and that for some people, they're just unwilling to let those go, understandably?
A little bit of that. For some people, they're where the T-shirt had particular significance because of who gave it to them, usually a member of a band giving it to them. But for a lot of people, what was attached to the T-shirt was, I suppose, moments in time that connected to our youth when we were far more hopeful. We were engaged in DIY activities. We wanted to make things happen. And I suppose some of the stories really blew me away. There was one story where the contributor of the T-shirt, he liked the band so much that he actually set up a record label so he could release their records. That was Paul Shanahan's T-shirt, and the band is Pet Lamb. So the T-shirt that he contributed is absolutely in bits. He says he uses it for gardening at times, but it's the cover of the first EP. And he designed the T-shirt on a photocopier after hours and work.
I'm fascinated as well by the idea of your in memoriam book. So where people can write about the T-shirts that fell apart or the ones they lost. You know, what have people been writing in that?
Well, how that came about was we had some job trying to harass, rustle up people to lend us their T-shirts. And a lot of people talked about T-shirts that they loved and that were lost to them. So to try capture those stories, we got a book printed up, and the cover says In Memoriam to T-shirts Loved and Lost. So visitors have been writing in that book. And my favourite story so far is the very sad tale of a favourite T-shirt that was discovered under the kitchen sink, covered in pink windoline, having been repurposed as a cleaning rag by the writer's father. And the girl who wrote that story, her sorrow is palpable in the story. And I think we could all identify with how we would feel having that particular T-shirt was a last T-shirt that had been given to her by the tour manager of the band. And she was absolutely heartbroken.
That's excuses for never speaking to your parents again. You grew up in Baldoyle in the 80s and early 90s. What do you remember about that time? What do you remember about live music? Where did you go?
Well, I was really fortunate, I think, growing up in Baldoyle, as were so many of us, because we had a really vibrant, different youth cultures there. There was Hoodies, Crusties, Punks, Hippies, Goths and Cure Heads, of course, very many of them. And one thing in particular that I remember was we all connected with each other, because I suppose one thing that was common among us was our sense of trying to set ourselves apart in some ways, but yet to make close bonds and connections with other people who shared our liking of particular bands, or indeed with punk ways of thinking and rebelling and living. But we were really fortunate to have Baldoyle Youth Club, and I hope it's still going the way that it was, because it gave the opportunity for young people to come together and put on their own gigs. So we had metal punk bands playing in Baldoyle Youth Club when we were only about 15, 16. And I think for many of us, it gave us that flavour of, if you want to see change, if you want something, you know, you can make it happen by getting it together with other people. And so many of us have been involved in, I suppose, putting on music in those earlier days, putting on gigs. There was many a time I had bands staying in my house as well. Many of us did. And then I think as we grew up, that can-do attitude remained. And that's another one of those themes, I think, that cuts across a lot of the stories is, you know, just how a T-shirt and the connection that you have with it and the connection that it gives to other people and to other ways of being can open up so many possibilities for living.
Tell me about your own favourite T-shirt.
My own favourite T-shirt is the one that, the only one actually that I've kept from that time. And it's a Flux of Pink Indians T-shirt. They were on the Crest label. And for me, what stood out about that T-shirt was it really connected me with, as obviously, more Flux songs, but to new friends and ideas and to just new ways of thinking and being. On the back of the T-shirt, it says, there's enough for all of our need, but not enough for all of our greed. And I suppose that was such a big part of punk rock, is consideration for other living things and just questioning our ways of living and of capitalism. And, you know, we don't have to live like that. There are so many other ways of being. And that T-shirt for me is something, those ideas are ideas that I still hold dear today.
Dare I ask, is it still wearable?
It's still wearable. It has two tiny holes that were pointed out to me, a number of stains. It's still wearable, but I don't know if it would physically fit me anymore.
Cliona Murphy, thank you so much for talking to us tonight on Arena. Cheers.
Thank you. Bye.
Sweat, Sounds and Stories, produced by 3345 and the Kiosk Project. Space runs at the Kiosk Project Art Space, Narrow West Street in Drogheda in County Louth until Saturday, February 28th. Now, if you think you know what a movie musical looks like, consider leaving your tap shoes and your jazz hands at the door. Our next guests on tonight's Arena are the creative forces behind one of the most audacious, feverish and wildly original films of the year, The Testament of Anne Lee. It's based on the true story of Anne Lee, a very real, incredibly influential 18th century figure. She was the founding leader of the Shakers, a religious sect that preached radical ideals for the time, including gender and social equality. But the way they worshipped is what gives the film its most spectacular sequences, because the Shakers sought spiritual transcendence through ecstatic, physically grueling dance and song, trembling to connect with the divine. The film is directed by Mona Fastfold, who co-wrote last year's awards-heavy outing The Brutalist, and at the absolute centre of it all is Amanda Seyfried, taking on the role of Mother Anne. She delivers a fearless, intensely physical performance that critics are already praising as some of the best work of her career. Sinead Egan recently had the chance to speak with both Mona and Amanda to talk about the agony and the ecstasy of bringing this utopian vision to the screen. Before we hear that conversation, let's hear Amanda Seyfried singing I Hunger and Thirst from The Testament of Anne Lee.
I hunger and thirst, I hunger and thirst, after true righteousness. I hunger and thirst.
Amanda Seyfried, Mona Fastfold, you're both very welcome to Arena. Mona, you've described the writing process for this film as a haunting experience. What was it about Anne Lee's story that refused to leave you alone, and how did you get to hear about her?
Well, I think the moment I discovered the story, I felt just this intense sense of urgency to tell it. And I think that's really how I know that this is a story worth telling, and that this is a story worth dedicating years and years of my life to. I discovered the story when I was doing research on The World to Come, the film I directed before this. I was, first of all, I was just astonished to discover that so few knew of her story. Thereon, the more I read about her, the more radical and interesting and full of paradox I found her journey and her life. And then of course everything just got more and more heightened in the world around us. So telling a story about someone who perhaps was America's first feminist felt important right now. And talking about community as well. The Shakers were one of the first, communities in America to provide social services, to provide a place for abused women to come, to take care of the elders, to adopt and care for orphans. So, as seeing all of these things also kind of disappearing around us, remembering, how that all began as well, just felt really interesting to sort of draw these lines between, the late 1700s and now.
Amanda, I've read that you didn't trust yourself initially to play Anne, and I'm curious about why that was and what changed to make you decide to jump in and embrace the role.
I think it was a lot to do with knowing full well that following Mona on this journey was going to be just a colossal challenge for me. I knew that playing somebody who was so empowered in such a way was going to, it was going to need a lot from me. And so part of art is fear, right? It comes, some of it comes from fear. And I think, I don't know if you can create the great art without a little bit of that. And I had a lot of that. So I think I really just absorbed Mona's trust in me in order to find my own ground in this. And then we did it together. I mean, it's not just a pure collaboration between us. It was everybody involved, all the departments, all the crew, every single person had a foothold in creating this. And so that also makes you feel safe to explore, because that's the thing. We're telling a story about somebody who was almost too good to be true. And you want to ground that because you want to make people believe that this woman existed.
And I mean, it's clearly a very different project from films that you've done before. And to be fair, I think that anyone's done before.
This is absolutely a singular masterpiece, I believe. Yes, I'm biased, but honestly, Mona doesn't do things lightly. And I think that's what's so incredibly unique about her, is that, yes, she's a female director who's very brave. We need more of that. But also, there's so little doubt. Like she said, if she feels this urgency, it drives her.
Mona, it's probably fair to say that the concept of ecstatic dance might have been a hard sell when it came to getting this project off the ground. Can you tell me about getting it to the green light stage and doing your proof of concept? How big a gamble was it?
I mean, it was just green light. I mean, we closed financing, I think, when we partnered with Searchlight. I mean, that's how long it took. We were really raising money, check by check while we were shooting the film. I was worried that the film was going to, that we're going to shut down every week. So it was sort of, I feel like we just willed this film into existence. I tried to pitch it, and there was always interest in the film. There was always, people were curious about it. But we couldn't really put it in a box. This type of movement that we have, that are part of our film, it's not a traditional musical, but it's definitely a musical. But bringing in modern dance in this way into, this sort of Americana piece of history there's so much contradiction in that, in a way, I think, that people just had a hard time wrapping their head around it. But I think that once I started showing people the movement and the music and the performances, then, of course, there was a lot of excitement for it. I kept trying to pitch it as, in the beginning, as it's Braveheart meets Dancer in the Dark or something. We tried all kinds of comps, and people just looked at us like, that's mental. Good luck to you.
But isn't that the beauty of art?
Yeah.
That we embrace newness, that we embrace uniqueness. Yeah. We celebrate so many men who are unafraid to go in the direction that they're called to. And, there's so many people still who you would have thought would have seen the movie haven't. And I think it's because they're a little bit afraid. And I think that's fucking awesome. I love that it challenges, this movie challenges people in a way, and then also just leaves them just with a new sense of understanding. That's the point. I will never stop celebrating it.
Amanda, you spent a long time, I think, mastering this 18th century working class Mancunian accent. And can I just say, it's excellent work.
Oh, God. Thank you. Honestly, I'll take it.
What was the key to unlocking Anne's voice and her demeanor for you?
I don't know.
So much work.
I just don't think I found the key. I still feel like I'm still working on it. Humility. Humility goes a long way. Knowing that it's gonna be hard. It will never come easy. That's why I think I'm so in awe of these actors who never use their own accent, because there's always a level of there's always a challenge. There's always a kind of you're kind of always listening to make sure it sounds right. And that is one of the hardest things to overcome, is to stop listening and to start feeling. Like I can do that with my singing voice, but with the Mancunian, I was struggling not to listen to myself as I was doing it, and that was really the thing that
I struggled. You found the character though. When once the accent,
yeah, all of
once
it.
You actually wrapped your head around the accent, which was months and months and months of work,
I needed that.
Yeah, Tandra Marshall, our dialect designer, really is what she is, because she did so much research building this accent, like building it on all of these different parts of research that we could find, and once it sort of, it started out so wonky. I remember you were like, Tandra was playing a voice note of you, and I was like, oh my god.
I got
a lot of work.
I'd send voice notes when I was feeding the animals, because I live on a farm, and I'd be feeding and I'd be talking to the animals in the Manx accent, and I would send the voice memos to Tanara and send it and say, oh, I can't even do it anymore, but and then listen, it starts from one place and it builds. You just have to spend time. It takes a lot of time to memorize anything. But it's really fulfilling once you're able to crack something. But humility goes a long way.
Finally, and to both of you, the film explores the agony and the difficulty of building a perfect society. And do you think that Anne's pursuit of this idea of a utopia resonates differently in 2026 than maybe it would have 10 or even 20 years ago?
Yeah.
Definitely. Yes.
Even from day to day, we're on the extreme again. We're at the breaking point, like a true breaking point. We thought a breaking point was 10 years ago, but it wasn't. I remember 10 years ago and thinking, oh, this is it. We're done. Mm-hmm. We're fucked. Mm-hmm. And then now it's just, I never, it's a Black Mirror episode. And it's just like, we need to remind people that history has something to say and it will always teach us something. And when we mine history and find characters and people like Anne Lee who were brave and doing what people saw as impossible, now it seems like, oh, of course, equality among gender and race, of course. Creating, loving thy neighbor, what's in the Bible, mm-hmm. of course. But we're not actively doing that. And we're seeing it being dismantled every day, the Constitution and what has been built in order to protect us, in order to be inclusive. And it's insane to have that stripped away so quickly. It's maddening because it's all based in fear. And the thing about Anne Lee is that she didn't lead with fear or coercive control or power. She wasn't greedy for power or money. She just wanted to create a safe place for everybody, where everybody was able to be taken care of and feel known and seen and loved in the world. And that's so far, we've lost so much sight of that. And it's unbelievable. I'm an American, and I am so happy to help portray and be part of art that reminds that humans can do better and have done better and will do better. That's it. That's my monologue.
Yeah.
Well, Mona Fastfold and Amanda Seyfried, I want to congratulate you on the film and thank you very much for speaking to Arena this evening.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You're listening to Arena.
That's it for this week's Arena Encore. You can listen to Arena Live on RTE Radio 1 every weekday evening from 7. And you can listen back via the RTE Radio Player, rte.ie, or wherever you get your podcasts.